listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
Hello, everyone. This is author Cal Wilson, and welcome to another episode of the Survival in Motion podcast. On today's episode, I have an interview with doctor and author Walt Browning, and we discuss several of his books, one of which I have read and really enjoyed. He's authored several books, and I'd encourage you to check them out. It's kind of funny in retrospect as I listen to this interview. We're both authors with several books we like to talk about and implicitly encourage you to buy our books, but it's kind of funny in this interview how basically most of the book titles, most of the author names, and most of the movie titles we managed to get wrong somehow. I even screwed up a verse in the Quran that I refer to a lot, which is Surah 9:5, kill unbelievers wherever you find them. The issue of Islam came up, and that's a verse from the Quran I always bring up. Whenever somebody says, oh, is Islam the religion of peace? I always bring that up, as well as a couple of others. You know, it's okay to kill Muslims who leave Islam. It's okay to terrorize non-Muslims, that kind of thing. And I always know that verse just right off the top. But for some reason, I managed to screw it up in this discussion with Walt Browning. All of this, whether it's book titles, authors' names, or movies, all of that is corrected in the show notes. Walt Browning did bring up one interesting medical issue. Now, here's the thing. If you've noticed, there are a number of prepper conferences out there where there will be workshops offered, you know, for a fee, and some nurse or doctor or medical professional will teach everybody present how to stitch, how to do suturing. And that's a valuable thing to know. Browning in this interview brought up the idea of an IV bag. And here's the setting, you know, theoretically, whether it's an EMP or societal collapse or whatever, that we or those around us could on occasion eat food that is not good for us, is not prepared right, and we wind up getting sick. And if somebody is throwing up nonstop and they have diarrhea problems, there's a possibility of dying of dehydration. And in that situation, it's good to know how to hook up somebody with an IV. And that way you can rehydrate their body, even if you can't feed them, give them water to drink. And if they won't keep it down, that's an issue. And I think that's important. I know I once had a dehydration issue after a trip I took to Central America a few years ago. I talked about that in a previous podcast. I think it was the podcast where I talked about diseases. Anyway, it's a real enjoyable conversation I had with Walt Browning here. I think it's fair to say he and I clicked towards the end of this talk. We had some gun talk, which is important among men and preppers in general. He talked about how to stop bleeding. And we exchanged some thoughts on medical tourism and dental tourism, and which is interesting. I might have an episode of the podcast strictly on that issue. There are two people I've talked to who have had, they've traveled to, of all places, Tijuana for dentistry work. And they are very satisfied customers. Of all places, Tijuana. I've always thought of Tijuana as a place where college students go during spring break and they have a wild time and they get arrested and they wind up having to call their families for bail money. But anyway, go figure. Dentistry in Tijuana, and it's or Costa Rica or whatever. I want to make a distinction real quick before we get on with this interview, and that is medical information versus medical advice. Medical information is what Walt Browning talks about throughout this interview, and it's good stuff to know. It's not focused on you, the listener, and your specific medical concerns. That would be medical advice. Medical advice is when you sit down with a medical professional, a doctor, a nurse, or whatever, and you tell them your medical history, you tell them what shots you've had, what diseases like smallpox, if whatever that you've ever had, hepatitis, whatever. And then you discuss with that medical professional your medical issues, and then that person makes a prognosis and prescribes pills or whatever course of action. That's specific medical advice. And that's not what we're offering here. We're just offering, Walt Browning is discussing medical information, which is good to know. And it's something that I think as preppers, we all need to keep in mind and learn from it. Like, for example, the IV bag. If somebody's throwing up and they have diarrhea, how do you rehydrate them? Well, with IV. That's good medical information to know, but it's not medical advice. So I just wanted to make that distinction. This was a good interview, a good conversation, and Walt Browning is clearly not only a good author, but he's a nice guy, and I hope to have him back on the podcast again in the future. This conversation is about 1 hour long, but it could easily have been 2 hours long. We just got to talking and back and forth, and it was a good conversation. Anyway, by the end of this interview, the audio quality got bad enough as to be distracting. So that's why at the very end I cut in and I do my goodbyes and I finish up the conversation that way, only because the Skype connection was getting pretty bad. And as was mentioned at one point during the conversation, there was a thunderstorm right nearby Walt Browning's aside. So anyway, enough yakking by me. I think you'll enjoy this conversation with doctor and author Walt Browning. Enjoy. Okay, Dr. Walt Browning, thanks for joining us here at the Survival in Motion podcast.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Walt, can you give us your background and tell us what made you start writing books?
It's a good question. I was originally, and I still am, a practicing doctor in Central Florida, and I became friends with a fairly famous prepper author, Angry American, or Chris Weatherman.
Okay, he changed his name from Furious to Angry. I'm just kidding.
I think it's always been Angry American.
Yeah, I know. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But he's he's a real good guy. I met him before he became too famous, other than through his books. And we actually have a homesteading group that he's part of, and a number of other people in the area. We get together on a monthly basis and learn prepping skills and things like that. But I think 2014, there was a lot of, I guess a good word is kerfuffle, about ISIS growing and developing, and the president, the administration at that time sort of poo-pooing it. And one of the statements that was made at a prayer breakfast by the president was that the Islamists were no different than the Crusaders. And I had enough history knowledge to know that was not true. The Crusades didn't occur until 350 years after Islam had forced, about a third of the European and Northern African population to convert to Islam, either by, telling them either you convert or you die. They let some live to pay a dhimmi tax, but they usually took the women and children as slaves and let the rest of the people live as long as they paid taxes. But for the most part, you either converted or died. And about 350 years after they did this expansion out of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, they controlled all of northern Africa, Spain, all the way up through into Turkey. And it wasn't until the people were trying to make journeys down to visit Jerusalem and were being killed and taken slaves that the church at the time sponsored a holy crusade to take Jerusalem over. So I was really angry about that, and I was talking to Chris, and he said, well, you know, why don't you write a book? So I wrote my first book, which is The Book of Frank. It's Isis and the Archangel Platoon, and essentially talked about a retired Marine who gets involved with a group of other retired military people, and they get hired by the Catholic Church to go into a small town north of Mosul and rescue some nuns and children who were trapped by ISIS as they expanded into the area. And the book is doing very well as far as ratings are concerned. And of course, I've got the book out on my desk, and the patients checking out are buying it, and you know, they liked it. But no one was buying the book on Amazon as far as getting a lot of play. So the next book, I talked to Chris and I said, hey, you know, I love your series. Would you mind if I wrote a companion novels that essentially I have a group of non-preppers in the middle of Orlando that get caught when the EMP in his book goes off, and they have to learn to survive with, you know, 500,000 visitors and 2 million people that are going to starve in a week. And that's the Charlie's Requiem series, and that's been successful. I'm writing my fourth book on that one. And that's how I got started.
Okay, yeah. And just as fair disclosure, I have read, of all your books, I've read only one. And this might sound like a cop-out, which actually it is, but it's a cop-out that makes sense. You and I write similar books, and I really try my best not to read books that are similar to what I'm writing, you know, because I don't want any, even a phrase or some kind of event or anything to kind of creep in there and wind up in my book that I just read it from somebody else's book, you know?
Right.
But I did read Charlie's Requiem, and I was very impressed with it. I could tell that you, the author, had a whole lot of medical experience and training, and it was also a different type. You know, a lot of these books are, let's face it, kind of similar general plots, but this book was different, and I really liked it, Charlie's Requiem. I didn't know that you had written that with the misnamed Angry American. The more I get to know that guy online, the more it seems like he's a totally friendly guy and not very angry at all.
You know? Oh, that's correct. He got that that name. He was a blogger back in 2007 and 2008, and he did a lot of traveling at the time. He was a I'm not sure if he was working as a linesman at the time or for a while he was installing high-end security systems for jails and courthouses. And he'd sit around and he had the interest. He's always been a prepper. And he was in a prepper group, and he's sitting around by himself in the hotel with his wife and kids back in Central Florida. And he decides to write a chapter of, you know, what would happen if the lights went out and he had to walk home because he was all over the Southeast. And he's essentially his character. He posted it on the blog, and all these people loved it. So he said that a couple nights later, he took a bottle of Jack Daniels, had a few drinks, and started writing again. And after about 7 or 8 blogs of several chapters, the people said, write a book. And, of course, that was the genesis of his first book. Angry American is simply his blog name, and he is the nicest person. He's a big, giant bear.
Yeah.
A really big guy.
Yeah, I'm impressed with what I've read about him. Anyway, I guess as a doctor, you're not tempted to write just a strictly doctor book, you know, with a guy in the hospital with, you know, nurses and curing... curing whatever diseases or anything? Probably not, I guess, huh?
Well, actually, no, I am.
Or are you?
I don't know. I've got 3 books in the hopper, only one of which is a continuation of the Charlie series. My just as an aside, my fifth book was a Kindle Worlds book that was written with
Nicholas.
Oh gosh, Nick Smith. I'm trying to remember the name of the series, but the bottom line is it was a Kindle World book, and I had read his books, which were a lot of fun, about a zombie apocalypse that is develops from a medical medical attempts by the military to make a better soldier. So I wrote a companion story, and that did very, very well with them. And so it got me into the zombie thing. And one of my three books is somewhat similar to that. It's more of a it's not quite zombies, but it's a mutated virus that terrorists create. But the second book I'm writing is very good. It's a medical murder mystery based on genetics. There's a truthfully, at Harvard right now, they are doing at the Harvard Institute of Aging. They're genetically modifying people to extend their chromosome lengths it's basically anti-aging. And they did this to rats and dogs. And essentially what they did was they took these animals' chromosomes and they repaired them. And I can get into that later if you're interested. But essentially, these animals lived a little bit longer than normal, but they died having the metabolism of an animal half its age. And what they're trying to do is genetically treat people so that you may die at 100 and never have had arthritis or diabetes or heart disease because you have the body of a 40 or 50-year-old.
And you're writing, you're writing a book based on that. That medical development.
Yes, what I'm writing a book on is that one of the workers at one of these labs discovers a way to truly turn someone young again, not just anti-age their body, but actually reduce their. And he ends up getting murdered, and it's a murder mystery where they find his body and they start uncovering what's going on, and all kinds of sinister people are behind it. I'm learning all about, which is the fun part about writing is you have to. Educate yourself. I'm learning more about genetics and, the biochemistry I learned in 1988 or 89 when I was in my residency, that encompasses the first three chapters of a 15-chapter book now. So it's so far advanced from what it was, and it's accelerating at a tremendous rate. And it's not out of the realm that we will be reducing our aging or being de-aged. If this works, within 5 or 10 years, they'll have genetics out that they will essentially de-age you and give you get rid of a lot of diseases. That is if the pharmaceutical companies ever let this see the light of day.
Well, I would imagine there would be a lot of money at stake for people, for companies that sell medications that would be obsolete if this comes true.
That's the point. I mean,
gotcha.
Harvard's doing it. They've already announced it. They started the trials about 4 months ago. And I'm going to wait and see if anything comes of it.
Okay.
It'll be very interesting.
When is this?
If nothing comes of it, I would look hard. As they always say, follow the money and you'll find out why things happen.
Yeah. When do you expect this book to come out?
Well, I've got three of them going. It's going to be this fall.
Oh, okay. Okay.
This fall. I'm one of those that I'll pick up a book and I'll write three or four chapters, and then I let it go, and then I pick up the other book, and I'll write three or four chapters, and then Charlie book, I'll probably sit down, and in 2 months I'll blast out another Charlie book, 2 or 3 months, and then finish up the other two.
Well, that's great. I think Isaac Asimov did that. He had several typewriters around his room, working on like 8 or 9 different books at the same time, and same idea, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very ADD, but like in that direction. It's been very beneficial in being a doctor because it makes learning a lot easier. And it's interesting. I can do 5 or 6 things at once, but I've got all these ideas for books, and it's just hard to get it all out, especially when you're working full time.
Yeah, you're telling me. Yeah, well, multitasking is something that. I've promised myself I would get around to, but never got to it because I'm too busy doing other things. Well, that joke fell flat. But hey, I wanted to ask you about Book of Frank, which, as I admitted earlier, I did not read, but I've kind of skimmed summaries of it and reviews. And as I understand, you've never been in the military, right?
Correct.
How did you How did you prepare yourself to write a military-type book that sounded as if you had been in the military?
Research, lots of blogs and books I've read. The hero in that particular book has a flashback memory, a number of chapters long, of his time in Fallujah. So I read several books and blogs and tried to make it as realistic as I could. I've actually taken private tactical lessons at up in West Virginia, and there's a couple of people in my area that train, but the West Virginia, flying up there and spending a week with a guy who was, you know, basically he was ex-SAS and then joined the Rangers, got his American citizenship and married an American woman. And going through that training was very helpful, so that you understand weapons manipulation, how to you know, small unit tactics, things like that. So I kind of combined doing fun things with and research with all, you know, to write the books to make them realistic.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. Are you a gun owner yourself?
Yes. Yes.
An issue that keeps coming up with my books, mm-hmm. which all involve my fictional books, which all involve gunfights.
Correct. Yeah, Jim and his gunfight with the old farmer out there that comes out and takes some pot shots at him. And,
oh, thanks. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank
yes,
you.
Yes.
It's been kind of a conflict in my own mind when I'm writing this stuff as to how realistic to make it, to portray it. You know, when I think any gun is incredibly loud, you
it
know?
Is. And suppressed.
It's hard not to write a book with gunfights where people, or not everybody's holding onto their ears, you know?
Correct. Yeah, that's very true. It's kind of a joke. Because a lot of my books are military themed, I've got a number of Facebook groups that are military themed and a lot of ex-military. And you know, I'm honest about my experience with them, but you hear a lot of the realism of what this would be like. I mean, it's just, you know, you'll read a book and the guy will pull a 45 out in a car or in a small room and shoot five times and then holster it. And it's like, and he just starts talking again. Well, that
right.
wouldn't happen.
Exactly. My ears would be ringing. Yes.
Correct. Correct. So, yeah, you just have to be around firearms enough to know, and not try to do more than you know.
Okay.
So, you know, if you are not around firearms a lot, the way you describe your books, you don't get into too much detail on it. Your choice of a M&P shield was very good.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
And the 308 rifle is a good rifle. And I like the fact that you got into him carrying too much weight and having to unload, because I get a lot of questions about prepping about, oh, well, what do you carry in your car? And my answer is always as little as possible, because if I have to walk, I'm in my 50s and I'm not going to be humping around a 70-pound pack and expect to get anywhere, you know?
Okay. Okay.
So, but yeah, you know, you write what you're comfortable writing in your zone. You need to be sure that you research it a lot and you're saying things that are true.
Yeah. I guess that's all you can do. Where do you come down as far as PTSD? I did actually pick the brain of a Marine who had been in Afghanistan, and I went on for a couple hours and I tape recorded it, and it was amazing to me how there really is a lot of PTSD, and it doesn't only involve gunshots. I mean, it involves people just being where there could be gunshots. And so it was tempting to me in that last book, and I don't think I'll do it anymore, but it was tempting to me to throw that in with the protagonist. And at the very end of the book, give a 1-800 number or whatever, because I think there are a lot of military and police even, and probably ambulance people who have PTSD. And I thought I was being, you know, a public servant, talking about it and giving out 800 numbers, but apparently I mean, it just landed with a thud. Nobody cared.
Right, right. Now, I think in books, people want to be mindless. And in some respects, you get a little bit of a license to be unrealistic in the lack of depth for some of your characters. I mean, the second Charlie book, the first Charlie book, there was none of that involved. There is a character in there who suffers from it because of abuse by his family. But the second Charlie book hits that more, where they get into town and now they have time to try to escape, and it hits them. And some of the characters are down in the basement crying and shaking, and they see people dying. And you know, in a situation where it's an acute situation like that, I'm not sure that PTSD is that ingrained yet. And I don't know enough about it to speak as authority. So this is my opinion. But I think a lot of the PTSD from talking to people in the military and researching my book to give these characters some humanity, a lot of it is the camaraderie that you're now in a completely different world. It's as if you're taken off the earth and thrown somewhere else with a group of people that all have the common goal of staying alive, and they support each other. It is as intimate as a marriage, if not more. And to have that taken away and all of a sudden drop back onto the earth where there is no more of this, that really screws with you. And there are neural pathways involved that get set up to deal with this. And then when you're taken out of that situation, those neural pathways don't just go away. I know here in Orlando, at the University of Central Florida, they're one of the premier computer-generated, I'm blanking out as I always do in these interviews, virtual reality. It's one of the premier virtual reality centers in the world, and they're doing experiments where they're putting these kids that are coming back from battle into situations where they are able to draw them down, put them in, have them do a virtual tour, walking the streets of Iraq, no gunfire, or some gunfire doesn't hurt them, then another one, and then they're trying to step them down. And they're trying to reprogram those neural pathways that are just so intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been some good books. If people are listening and they don't know what we're talking about, On Killing by Grossman is a great book on similar, you know, this issue. And there's a great movie out after World War II called The Best Years of Their Lives, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they called it Shell Shock, but I think it's the same idea.
Absolutely.
And I think it's only realistic, and I think it's something that if you're trying to be real, you know, have a realistic fictional book with gunplay, I think there's got to be some of that.
There is. I mean, as I said on my Charlie book, the being in that type of an intense situation for a number of days, and when you finally get the chance to catch your breath and you realize that the world is different and you don't know what you're doing, it does become overwhelming. You triggered something when you were talking about that. Maybe I'll come back to it. I apologize, but it was something to do with shell shock or
movie?
PTSD, and I'll think of it later. It may come back, but anyway, let's go ahead.
That movie, the Best Years of Their Lives. Well,
yeah. Oh, I remember what it was. Very good. That triggered it. I read in doing some research that the military that is over in the sandbox in Iraq and over in Afghanistan are essentially in, when they look at how many days they're in an actual combat zone where they are getting fired on or they're hearing shots or whatever, on an average during a year, it's over 200 days a year. And when you looked at World War II veterans that were actually in combat or in a fire zone, it was less than 2 weeks. Hmm. There was a lot of battles, and then they pulled back and they didn't do anything, and others went forward. But it's the constant intensity that has really created such an issue with PTSD. And of course, you've heard the term that 22 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan kill themselves every day.
Absolutely. That was a statistic I doubted until I did a whole lot more research in it. And that's a figure that is repeated by people with credibility. That it
absolutely.
Really, it really happens.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, another issue I wanted to ask you. How do you feel about the Muslim issue in your Book of Frank? And I guess what I'm asking is how genderly do you feel that you need to wade in that issue?
Well, in the Book of Frank, it's they're fighting jihadists. And during the book, they talk about how they were taking other Muslims captive and raping and killing the girls there. One of the written print Book of Frank is much more descriptive, and you know, there's some really mean, nasty scenes in there. For the Kindle, and interestingly, Nick Smith talked to me about it. He said, you really got to tone this down. So on the Kindle version, a lot of the abuse scenes and things have been taken out or cut back. But I was honest. You know, one of my good friend of mine who was doing my Facebook account for a while is gay, and there are scenes in there where they take gay men and throw them off a parapet or bleed them out until they die. And he was very upset about it. And I said, Randy, this is life. This is what they're doing. You can't bury your head. So, and I was very honest and open. I didn't make it all about them killing Christians only. They were going after Muslims and other, you know, that might have been Sunni and they were Shia or vice versa. So it's, you know, ISIS is basically a Sunni. So, you know, they were taking Shia Muslims and killing them and taking their children. And it is reality. It is truth. Fortunately, we've been able to, you know, kick their butts. And now they're another French group, although they are still in Libya. And they're trying to make headway into some of the African nations right now.
Yeah. At the risk of being politically correct, yes, jihadists do kill Muslims. In fact, I think other Muslims, that's probably their top group of victims right there.
80% of their victims.
Yep. And as far as other groups, Christians, through the years, I've kept track of verses in the Quran where it says to kill Christians wherever you find them. And the blowback I've gotten in the past from even approaching this issue, even if it's totally benign, has been from just, hey, how can you say that? Not, you know, not from Muslims who are offended, but non-Muslims who are offended on behalf of Muslims. You know what I mean?
Well, it's just an offensive, I don't want to say religion, but they haven't gone through a reformation like Christianity has. Although it wasn't, you know, in Christianity, like, for instance, in the Spanish Inquisition, which was rather bleak, that was primarily a political murders of Muslims and Jews that were supporting the Muslims in Spain. And the church tried to dissuade them, the Catholic Church did. But they, you know, they were going to go through it and kill the people, and it was a political purge, essentially.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is, unfortunately, Islam spread through conquest. They conquered all of northern Africa. They conquered Spain for 700 years by taking over towns and commanding they convert or killing the men and enslaving and the women and children. And, you know, that's a fundamental difference in the way Christianity was spread, which essentially was by martyrdom. People believed they were martyred. They wouldn't give up. And eventually Constantinople in 300 made it the official religion of Rome. Mm-hmm. So, but it wasn't by the sword. I'm not saying there weren't instances and eras where the Catholic Church wasn't wrong, but they certainly didn't do their majority of their spreading by the sword. Now, today, Islam is not spread by the sword in many places, and people convert willingly, but there's still not a denial I think there's fear in denying or challenging the jihadists. There's a fear there because there are enough 1 or 2% that might agree that you never know if you're not going to get a knock on the door if you're Muslim and you try to absolutely, you know, change things or stop this.
Yeah.
So it's very tenuous for a Muslim to do that. And I don't know how much of that is they're truly like, oh, wow, this is cool. I really believe this, but I can't come out and say that we have to convert everyone. Or if they're just saying, I'm not going to say a word because I don't want to, have my throat cut.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the non-Muslims who take the greatest offense because I think, I'm not Muslim, but I get the impression from the outside looking in that the Muslims, the non-jihadi Muslims, know exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
And they know the threat that they face. And it's, non-Muslim liberal Americans who take such great offense at those of us like you and me who point out from time to time, that the jihadists are out there. I'm writing a book right now, a sequel to my EMP book, where jihadis are in town and they're racking up a pretty big death toll.
Right.
And I know as I'm writing this, I'm going to get some flack, but it's, do you want to portray this as realistic or, you want to sugarcoat everything?
Right. Exactly. You've got to write the truth as you see it, without being over the top. In the Book of Frank, I was very clinical about it. It's, I describe situations that I read about that are true. I never got any blowback from it from my readers. But my readers, this is a very positive Christian-centric book that talked about jihadis and what they're not what necessarily they were doing to Christians, because when they invaded this town, Tal Kaif, they drove out half of the Muslims that didn't want to be killed. They're the worst of the Quran and it is true. Now, I'm not, you say that without indicting all Muslims, but these jihadists, ISIS, were bad.
It's time to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Head to Cabela's for hunting and outdoor gear. It's all field tested, field proven. You can trust our gear. Shop three ways and find everything you need. Cabela's, world's foremost outfitter.
Because we don't just expect the unexpected, we prepare for it. Because home should feel like home, no matter what. Why are Mountain House meals the premium choice for emergency food storage? Because our food tastes better and has the longest proven shelf life, period. Your family can depend on Mountain House for both food and comfort. Anytime, every time. We don't do things the easy way. We do them the right way. We do it because we're Mountain House.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum is one of Southern California's most beautiful destinations. History literally comes alive here. Museum guests can step aboard and tour through President Reagan's Air Force One, tail number 27,000, view an exact replica of the White House Oval Office, touch an authentic piece of the Berlin Wall, stroll through replicas of the White House Rose Garden in South Lawn, reflect at President Reagan's memorial site, and so much more. Interactive exhibits explore the American presidency, as well as the life and legacy of President Reagan. Deliver the inaugural address on the steps of the U.S. Capitol using a teleprompter. Study the history of White House state dinners and create your own china pattern and floral arrangements. And even act in a movie with Ronald Reagan using green screen technology. For information on pricing, hours, and museum exhibits, please visit ReaganLibrary.com.
You're listening to the Survival in Motion podcast with author Cal Wilson.
Hey, can I ask you a few questions about Charlie's Requiem? How many Charlie's Requiem books do you have out now?
Three. The first one's a novella. That's one that I wrote that to see if there was interest. That's probably the one you read, the Charlie's Requiem, a novella.
Right.
And then the next one is Democide, which introduces what Angry American, his theme in his book is that the government is using this as a way of taking control and eliminating people that they don't like. And so that's the theme of that book. And then the third book, the second full-length book, or the third book is Resistance, where they start to gel and form a resistance to what's going on.
Okay.
So I've sort of got to follow his timeline, and once he writes a book, then I can use that time frame and certain things that occur in his book to have them occur in my book and sort of move things towards a conclusion with his.
Okay. So the whole thing starts with an EMP attack, right?
Correct.
What's your feeling about EMP? It occurred to me that although it's the worst case scenario, which makes it less likely than, say, a fire or a flood in next month, but even though it's the worst case scenario, I don't think it's quite as far-fetched as everybody thinks. That's my feeling about it anyway.
I think that there are ways that you could do this that are fairly easy. If you read any of Frank Horton's books, I think Franklin Horton's one, but I mean, even if there are probably 7 or 8 major areas that if you took out the electric, I'm trying to remember the name, but if you hit 7 or 8 of these, even with regular explosives and took them out, you'd knock down the power grid for 3 months or longer. And the thing about EMP is it's not that hard to do.
Right.
You know, like in your book, you know, 2 or 3 camouflaged ways of going about it, and you could really knock things down. I think the thing about an EMP is it's so devastating, it makes for good writing.
Yes.
Chris and I talked about this a lot, and his research and mine sort of shows that, you know, we don't think all the cars are going to get knocked out. We don't think that even a lot of the newer cars are going to get knocked out. That to have an EMP that puts that kind of energy out, having multiple EMPs, you'd have to have a lot of them. And even then, a lot, you know, like I've got an 87 pickup with a fuel injector, and it does have one computer. It's an old computer. I don't know that it would get knocked out if an EMP did go off, but it makes for really good writing in case it did, because now you're back to 1800.
Well, another thing, a lot of EMP books start with, hey, look at what happened at Starfish Prime, which, of course, is something to consider, but there was also a test in the 50s done by the U.S. military. I wish I could remember the name, but all they did was use a weather balloon with a pretty small nuclear bomb, and that produced an EMP. And
right.
That's why in my EMP book, I figured one of these lost suitcase nukes from the old Soviet Union, you know, if you can find a weather balloon, you know, that's all you would need. And weather balloons are really cheap.
Well, the one thing you put in there, too, which is very valid, is the North Koreans and their nuclear devices have been tuned to create a lot of EMP radiation. So it's the thing about an EMP, though, the only thing you have to remember is we have military all over the world. The one bad thing that would dissuade someone from doing it, unless they were, of course, like in your characters, the you know, jihadis that are totally don't care what happens. An EMP attack on this country may as well be a nuclear attack. And if the Soviets or some definable country tried to do that, we'd pretty well wipe them out. And I think they'd know that. So, you know, if Iran did an EMP attack and did this to us, I can guarantee you a Trident submarine is going to take out that entire country.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of there are a lot of consequences to that kind of an attack. However, as you put in your book, you get crazies, or if you can somehow do it where no one knows who did it, then it could be, you know, they've had congressional hearings on it. Newt Gingrich is a huge, he's been warning about this since 2004. So there are congressional hearings. There's a congressional, the House released a report that says we need to do X, Y, and Z and harden our systems, but nothing seems to be. It makes you wonder, not much is getting done.
Well, I think the reason why is because in order to harden the grid, I think you'd have to tell electricity companies you've got to do this and you've got to spend extra on that and stuff like that. And I think there's some resistance on their part, you know, not wanting to spend extra on their infrastructure. Sure. That's my theory anyway.
Well, yeah, money. But, you know, that's never stopped the government from telling people what they want them to do. There's just no, you know, there's no urgency here.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah, is that the general public is not frightened enough, and yet the electricity companies have a lot of money at stake. So they're willing to spend money on lobbyists, and the general public is right now not very worried about it.
Correct. You know, it's the old, you know, keep the circus happy, free bread and entertainment.
Yep.
And, you know, they can get away with whatever they want.
Well, anyway, your last book that I wanted to talk about, Lost Valley.
Yes.
That was it's called A Kindle World, which I'm not sure our listeners would know. That's where one book comes out by one author, and then a number of other authors, it's like fan fiction, right?
Yeah, the way it goes is they'll find someone who has a very successful, well-selling book or series of books, and they'll ask that author, do you know any other authors that might be interested in writing novellas or companion stories? And they'll promote it as a Kindle world based around this one well-liked book. And there are probably 20 or 30 Kindle worlds out there in all different genres. And what happens is Amazon will contact you as the outside author, and you'll get an email from the main author and say, hey, how would you be interested in doing this? And Amazon says, well, we'll give you $500 to help cover the cost of editing. Will you do it? And I'm like, well, sure. And so you just need to make sure you know that this person's work and his characters and what his world is about. And then you can either, like, it's usually 10 authors, and you'll pick a topic. You'll run it by the main author and say, this is what I want to write about. And then it's all up to you. And then what happens is you split the profits with the main author.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. In your book, it was called Lost Valley. And I think that was a Kindle world of a book written by Nicholas Sansbury Smith.
And
I can't remember what his book was named, but I thought it was interesting in your book that you wrote. Am I correct? The protagonist was a dog?
Well, it's one of the quote unquote characters. My wife read a book, there are several of them, The Art of Racing in the Rain, A Purpose of a Dog. It's in fact, they try to make a movie of it, but it's where the primary character in those books was a dog thinking and his thought process. In Nicholas's book, he has a dog that everyone loves. It's one of the characters that runs with his Special Force Delta unit. I thought, well, everyone loves dogs.
Yep.
And so this is not the main character, but the book starts with the dog sitting on the porch of his handler, who is a retired SEAL, and they're up in the mountains outside San Diego, and you hear him thinking to himself about how lucky he is, how he ended up here, and he goes through how he met his handler, and throughout the book, you'll have his reference where he might come across one of the zombie creatures that are associated with Nick's books. And he calls them, I talk about how he's got this ancient memory from his bloodline, and he smells this thing, and it smells like poison. The only thing he can think to call him is an asp, like the ancient Egyptian dogs. You knew them as asps.
Oh.
And so you have this dog sort of adding to the story as, you know, one of probably about 10 to 50% of the writing is his thinking. The rest of it deals with the humans.
That's great.
It was really fun. People really, really took to it.
Yeah, it looks like it's everybody who read it is very happy with it. That's amazing.
Well, the one thing I can tell you, and my wife told me this, and Nicholas told me this, if you write about a dog, you better not kill it.
Ah, okay.
I told him what I was doing, and he goes, whatever you do, don't kill the dog, because a lot of his fan mail was, do not kill your dog. We love your dog. And so that's... you can count on the fact that if there's a dog in one of my books, it's not going to die.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Okay, well, so it's safe to read your books where dogs are involved.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
On behalf of your readers, I thank you.
You're safe. You're safe.
Okay. Can I ask you a few other questions?
Sure.
You mentioned you have some firearms. Do you have a CHL or anything to enable you to carry?
We were concealed carry permit. We call that here in Florida CCP.
Oh, okay. Okay. What kind of weapons do you have, or what are you packing?
Well, I used to own a shield. I actually traded it in on for my concealed carry weapon. I use a Ruger LC9S, which is a relatively inexpensive personal 9mm. It's a little smaller than – it's one of those things where it fit in my hand better, and I carry on for lack of a better word, it rides on my belt in a nylon scabbard, if you can think of it. And then I have my shirt outside of the belt. So it's actually outside the belt carry with a shirt hanging over it.
And that's, you like that better than the shield?
I like the shield a lot. That was really the first small micro 9mm out there. And it is probably still one of the best. It's just bigger than the one I carry. And for my body, and for what I carry, when I put this on, and I've tried several others, as a doctor, I have the money to do these stupid things. I'll buy one, I'll run with it. If I don't like it, I'll trade it in on something else. And I ended up with probably one of the least expensive 9mm, the LC9S, which has a really, really good striker fire trigger. It's almost like shooting a Glock. You can pick them up for $260.
Wow. Okay.
So they're really a great bargain.
Yeah, I like how Ruger's feel in my hand. That's true.
Well, I do have a rubberized sort of a grip thickener on there, and that gives me the best grip because I find the Ruger for my hand size is a little small on the handle, but adding the rubberized part of it. Over it really makes it ride perfectly, and it's got 7 shots,
okay,
and which is plenty. And I carry a spare magazine in case I have a malfunction,
okay,
so that I can strip it and put a new one in. But most gun battles, if you're ever unfortunate enough to be in one, and the number one rule of a gun battle is not to have it, but if you're ever forced into one, most gun battles only 3 shots are taken, 2 to 3 shots.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need a massive amount of firepower. 7 rounds should be more than enough, which I think the Shield has 7+1, and a very, very nice handgun.
Yeah, I like it. Can I ask you, as a doctor,
yes,
what about first aid kits? Would you add or subtract anything that the rest of us have in our first aid kits?
The big thing is to have a trauma kit, a blowout bag. As far as, I carry one in my back of my car, along with just a generic Amazon $25, 300-piece first aid kit. But I have, compression bandages. I've staged and have my there's quite a thunderstorm going here. I'm in Central Florida. There you go.
Wow.
Nice thunder. I also have my tourniquet staged and ready to be pulled out if I need it. And I, of course, when I go to the gun range, I always have that in my gun bag as well.
Huh. That's a good idea. What about antibiotics and fish antibiotics?
They apparently work well. They're the same thing that you can get from a physician. I can get antibiotics without having to go that route. So as a physician, I've got the ability to get my own antibiotics from regular suppliers and things like that.
I was in an online chat that penicillin is pretty much losing its ability to help out.
You go with amoxicillin, but that's a real problem. One of the things, one of the things that I would be just as concerned about as an EMP is viral, and from two standpoints. Number one, the HIV virus is now mutated in HIV-2, and it is resistant, and the traditional antivirals are now not effective. So that's a big problem. And, of course, Ebola just took off in the Congo, and they're going to try a new Ebola vaccine. But like anything in nature, it's going to mutate. So that's a concern as much as an EMP, and people need to keep an eye out on that. I've got actually a Google alert set up that I set up for flu, HIV, epidemic is one, and I get reports from Google every day on any news article that might contain anything along those lines. So I keep up on a lot of this, so it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, the last time I looked into Ebola, of course, there was that movie about that missionary, you know, with the Franklin Graham Ministries over there
right.
in Liberia.
Right.
But, and there was that, I forget what it's called, but they did develop a vaccine that worked with that one guy.
Right.
But there was always kind of, as far as what I researched, something called Marburg, which is just as serious, but has never really broken out of deepest, darkest Congo. And the word is that if it ever did, we'd be in pretty bad shape.
Yeah, it's the thing about viruses and anything infective, the smaller the infective vector, the smaller the virus or the RNA strand, the more likely it is to be able to mutate. So you just, you know, we get into a trap of thinking, oh, if we get a vaccine for this, we don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, that's not true, because something is, nature will change and alter things, and it creates all kinds of mutations, and something's going to stick. Marburg is very bad. In fact, one of the books I'm writing about, sort of inspired by Nick Sansbury, is one of the three books I talked about is a terrorist sets off a nuclear device near a level 4 biohazardous lab and ends up irradiating all their Marburg and rabies and everything else, and while it destroys most of it, some of them combine and get irradiated and turn into a virus that's thrown into the air, and it spreads all over the world, and it turns the world into mutates the world.
Wow!
Anything that gets in touch with it. So
what a disaster!
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously science. One of the neat things about writing that book for Nick about quote unquote zombies, I mean, you can do anything. You don't have to research. You don't have to.
Yeah.
You can have basic science, and you can just run with it. And so this is actually a lot of fun. I actually hired an illustrator to draw out my four main protagonists, the four teenagers that are actually being genetically altered to be able to withstand the zombies and their poisons and to become fighters. And it's 50 years in the future, and it's kind of fun. It really is, because they can do all kinds of 50 years of science that we will never know about, that they can, you know, it's pure science fiction. One of the funny things about my book that you were talking about, Lost Valley, is one of my reviews, the reviewer said, you know, dogs wouldn't have this good of vocabulary. It was a good book, but that's just so fake. And I'm thinking, dude, you're reading a zombie book. You know,
what's wrong with this picture?
What belief system did you leave intact to do that? But it's fun. It's fun. But getting back to your original question, it's antibiotics, bacteria becoming resistant to it. What I would recommend is that you try to get antibiotics that would help things that you might run across in a grid down situation. You're going to look at maybe around someone who could run an IV bag. Because vast majority of people that are going to die from that are going to be from waterborne diseases, that diarrhea is going to basically dehydrate you to a point where you die. And so you need to be able to hydrate people. If you not the people that come down with problems, you're looking at, as in, you know, in your other book, the cheap, inexpensive prepping things is to make sure you know how to make a Gatorade, get those ions back into people's bodies. But if you're vomiting and having diarrhea, it's hard to replace orally. And you're knowing how to do an IV or having someone in your group that can do IVs and have access to saline even bagged water, you know, is really going to help.
Okay, can I ask you about, you mentioned a trauma kit. I imagine a lot of that involves suturing, also known as stitching, right?
Let's see. Sutures are a part of it. If you want a trauma kit for now, all you've got to do is worry about stopping the bleeding and making sure the people, you know, breathing, heart and bleeding. You know, your first thing is their heart going? Are they breathing? And if they're not breathing, make sure you open the airway and make sure you can keep them open and breathe for them. Heart, you know, you got to make sure you know how to do heart compressions. The bleeding is where you're going to, you need to be able to stop the bleeding. And suturing in today is not important as long as you can get them to a trauma center in a half hour or 20 minutes. But if it's gripped down, yeah, you got to know how to suture. The problem is in the infections afterwards. You've got to be able to clean things out and put them on antibiotics. And today, it's almost you have to do IVs. Oral will help, but it depends on what your, you know, a gunshot wound needs IV antibiotics.
Are there any books or YouTube channels you'd recommend as far as educating people on stuff like this?
There's a guy who's called Skinny Medic who does a lot of, he has sell things which are actually not badly priced and fairly reasonable, but you can look up on suturing, which is helpful. What you do is you get sutures, you can get relatively inexpensive needle holders and sutures, which are harder to get by, but what you need to do is you need to do what I did when we first started. You get a big slab of meat, cut it, and learn how to do sutures, learn how to do different types of sutures. As far as training is concerned, you know, we talk about a first aid kit. And in today's society, if you're not in a grid down situation, there are really two things to have a first aid kit for, either to carry or in your car. One is for day-to-day stuff. You know, you can buy a nice kit on Amazon for $30 that has 200 or 300 pieces and Band-Aids and things that you would use for non-lethal situations. But if you get into a motor vehicle accident or gunshot wound, your primary goal is to control bleeding because suturing, that would be grid down and you'd have to pick your appropriate person to use that on. But as far as if it's today's society where everything's working, you just want to be able to control the bleeding. And you can go on YouTube and see things, but your best bet is to take a class. And there are people that do trauma classes that'll teach you the basics of how to pack a wound, how to use a flutter valve or something to control a sucking chest wound. The whole idea is to keep the blood inside the person until they can get to a hospital. So I've got two kits in my car. I've got the basic $30 Amazon kit. I keep, you know, aspirin and things for stuff like that. But the rest of the, I have a blowout bag kit, something that I would carry in a tactical situation if I was in a grid down and I'm doing, you know, we're patrolling the perimeter or we're moving from one point to another. That's attached to my battle belt, and that's got, you know, I've staged a tourniquet, I've got hemostatic agents, I've got compression bandages, and knowing how to use them and such, you're best off taking a four-hour class on that.
Well, it occurred to me, and this is probably not a grid-down type thing, but there are two situations I'm aware of where, you know, obviously the grid was still up, but there was a gunshot victim, and somebody just held out their hand and just kind of stopped. It's like they put their hand right on the gunshot hole and kept the blood inside the body. You know, there was that train to Paris. I can't remember the name of it, but it was based on a true story. And that American who was on that train, I think like a Brit got shot, and he just held his hand on the guy's neck and just kept the blood inside the body.
Correct.
So I guess
correct.
That, if nothing else, you can always do that. Of course, that's, like I said, only when the grid is still up.
Correct. But,
and then Gabby Giffords, when she was shot, somebody did that for her, and she made it through.
Correct. On the one of the neck wound, he had a bleeding jugular, and they just simply compressed it so that the blood wasn't, you know, you know, they had to be careful not to cut off the vagal nerve, but they kept it compressed enough that he was able to keep the blood in the body. On a gunshot wound, you've got a hole, and usually the bullet, as it goes through the body, it has a compression wave that goes ahead of it that rips a large space, and the blood will pool in that space and then come out. And in those situations, if they've got a hole, and you know, it could be from one side to another, you need to pack that wound. They're going to bleed out internally. They could lose a liter of blood inside that's not being circulated in their body, and their blood pressure will crash. Hmm. So, you know, if you have the guts to do it, you know, and you'd have to have the right stuff, you know, tearing off pieces of T-shirts and stuffing it in there works. But there are, you know, for not too much money, there's gauze, almost like giant long ribbons that have hemostatic agents, and you just pack and pack and pack and pack. You could put two or three of those in there and eventually get the pressure inside that wound. So it all depends on where the bullet hole goes. And anything you can do to stop the bleeding is what you want to do, is keep the blood inside in the circulation system so that it's oxygenating the brain and the heart.
Okay. And of course, that guy who was on the train, I think he had some medical training, so he probably knew a lot more than what he was doing than what somebody like me would know.
Well, he got nicked in the neck. It didn't blow through his neck. He got shot enough that it opened up the bleeding, and it was simply a matter of putting your finger over a slit and keeping it from bleeding out, which is great, but if you have a hole punched through the abdomen, you can't put your finger over that.
Okay.
So, and again, it depends on how far you want to go. If you want to be really prepared and you're ready to do it, you know, for instance, if you are training with rifles, you need to have a blow-up bag and you need to know how to use it, because even a ricochet, I've been out on a range where we've been shooting at steel targets, and you hear a zing go right by you, and that zing is within 10 feet of you. Mm-hmm. If you hear a bullet go by, it's within 10 feet.
Okay.
So at least on the range where it's coming back, 10, 15 feet, it's right over your head. So you never know when something like that's going to happen.
Yeah. Have you read the book Where There Is No Doctor?
No, I have not.
Okay. Just curious. Okay, I've got one kind of off the wall question. I've always wanted to ask a doctor if that's okay with you. And
sure.
From the magic of editing, we can always delete this question and your answer if you'd like. So
sure,
feel
sure.
free. Do you have any thoughts on medical tourism?
Depending on what you're going to be having done, it's not a bad way to go.
How so?
A lot of dentistry, major dentistry, if you've been diagnosed here and you're looking at $30,000, $40,000 for all these implants or whatever, if you are lucky enough to find the right person in Costa Rica or Hungary or something like that, you can actually be treated well. I've never researched it, but I've seen patients who've gone overseas to do that, and it's worked. A lot of heart surgeries work well in India. They're Western trained. You just have to do a lot of research and contact people that have had it done and find out who did it. I mean, it's like anything, even here, if you're getting a big, if you're not in an emergency situation and they're telling you you need to do X, Y, and Z, you get a second opinion.
Okay.
And that's always a positive.
Yeah, that's a possible subject of a future podcast, because so long as we're still stuck with Obamacare, I think it's an option that a lot of people are going to have to consider, at least for one-time operations. I think if it's something like chemo where you have to keep going back, that's different. But
right.
My impression is like a hip replacement or a valve replacement, that might be something that can be addressed, you know, overseas.
Well, absolutely. You can go overseas and have a nice, I know it's not a vacation, have your chest cracked open, but you can go over to India and spend 2 or 3 weeks there. Tell they take really good care of you. You're in a very high-end, beautiful recovery room. Your bed in the hospital is top-notch. And spend one-fifth the money you would if you went down to your local heart, had heart surgery done here. So it makes total sense. If you've done the research.
Okay, I'll have to end it here myself. The audio quality from here on was getting so bad it was kind of distracting. So let me just finish up by thanking Dr. and author Walt Browning for joining me here today on the Survival in Motion podcast. I'd like to say that Walt Browning can be found at his blog, which is waltbrowning.com. Also, you can press the follow button when you look him up on Amazon, and that way you'll be notified when he has any new books coming out. I understand he's also on Facebook, just as Walt Browning. Right now he has 4 books out, 3 of which are the Charlie's Requiem series that he co-authored with the misnamed author Angry American, and also 1 book on his own called The Book of Frank. I've read one of these books, and I really enjoyed it. Not only the medical knowledge, but the feeling that the author, it read to me like somebody who had been right there on the front lines in the military, but apparently that was not true. But they were good. It was a good book I read anyway. Walt Browning tells me that there is another Charlie's Requiem book coming out with the subtitle Retribution, probably co-authored again with Angry American, and that will be out this fall of 2018. And the Lost Valley book, which was a Kindle World book associated with a book by the author Nicholas Sansbury Smith. Amazon has announced that they are doing away, they're discontinuing the Kindle World format. So Walt Browning will somehow be republishing that book. Be watching for that. It's called Lost Valley, which that was the book we talked about where one of the protagonists is a dog, which I thought was different. Anyway, a very enjoyable discussion I had with Walt Browning. He and I really clicked, and I hope to have him again on the Survival in Motion podcast. I hear the music. That means our time is up. Thank you for joining me. God bless.